The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Michael Tracy is a reporter for TYT Politics and a freelance journalist who has written for Vice, The Nation, Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, The Intercept, and The New Republic, along with many other publications. He has also been a skeptic of what he calls Trump hysteria and of the Russia conspiracy. On this week's episode of the Zero Books podcast, we discuss the possibility of a Trump impeachment, whether Trump should be considered a fascist, and just how dangerous the Russia collusion narrative really is. It's Wednesday, May 24th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that Angela Nagel's book, Kill All Normies, and Brian Willem's novel, Henry Henry, is available for pre-order through Amazon. Henry Henry is an experimental novel comprising two alternating stories, one a factually inaccurate pseudo-biography of 17th century composer Henry Purcell, and the other the story of Purcell's mid-20th century biographers. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features the second half of a conversation with Zero Squared guests, and sometimes features conversation with Zero Books readers about the state of the left. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with Zero Books authors and others. The music you're listening to right now is a theme from Tetris, as performed by Sonia Belousova. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Michael Tracy and I discuss obstruction, impeachment, and Russia. Michael Tracy is a reporter for TYT Politics and a freelance journalist who has written for Vice, The Nation, Rolling Stone, The Guardian, The Washington Post, The Intercept, The New Republic, and it goes on and on. Recently, like anyone else covering national political news, he's been writing and reporting on the Trump-Russian collusion story, which is what we'll be talking about today primarily. But Michael Tracy, thanks for coming on the Zero Books podcast.
Great to be with you.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm most interested in getting your opinion about Trump's recent dismissal of the FBI director, James Comey. I mean, since I contacted you, so much has happened. We could probably talk about the classified information that he gave to Russian ambassadors. We could talk about Comey's memo. We could talk about all sorts of things, but I'm particularly interested in the possibility that Trump obstructed justice. But before we start talking about that, I just wanted to ask you to kind of introduce yourself to people who are listening and may not know who you are, and to ask you what your politics are. You know, you seem to be a writer from the left. You've been labeled as part of the alt-left by James Wolcott. He threw you in with Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald and Cornel West and Freddie DeBoer. But I've noticed that while you've written for The Nation and Mother Jones and Truth Dig, you've also written for The American Conservative. So I just wanted to ask you how you would characterize your politics. And do you think of yourself as part of this alt-left And if so, what does that tell you about the character of this alt-left, if anything?
Well, first off, I'm very happy to be grouped in with those people. I wouldn't take that as an insult in the slightest.
Right.
I think the term alt-left has kind of emerged as this cheap pejorative that people who kind of want an analytical shortcut to describe people that they just don't like have adopted. In terms of my own political disposition, you know, this is a question I get constantly, and it's true that I've written consistently for the American Conservative now for a number of years, and one of the reasons why I chose to write for the American Conservative is that they gave me incredible freedom to write what it is that I wanted. And while I could have gone to a different outlet, I found the exercise useful in that writing for a at least nominally conservative outfit, actually a number of leftists have written for the American Conservative, writing for a nominally, at least nominally conservative outfit forces you to sort of train your mind so you can communicate ideas and arguments to the broadest possible audience without necessarily relying on slogans or relying on the presumption that people already agree with you, which I think is a tendency that lends itself to a lot of lazy thinking. So that's always what I wanted to avoid, and actually writing for the American Conservative allowed me an opportunity to at least hone that trait or attempt to. I was always very upfront, had a great fruitful relationship with the American Conservative editors, and they knew that I never identified as a conservative, but they valued my contributions nevertheless. In terms of the label that I would use to identify myself, you know, I kind of am weary of this fixation with assigning people different labels. And it's not that I want to be this no labels person floating above it all and, you know, shunning the ideological battles, which are real and which should be carefully parsed. It's just that I so often feel that this assignment of one label or another is just used as sort of a way to pigeonhole rather than to actually elucidate. So I try to avoid assigning one to myself. I mean, I would rather that my arguments and that my ideas be assessed on their merits rather than in relation to some label that I've proclaimed for myself.
Yeah, it's always been tough to do that, to get people to just listen and analyze your actual arguments rather than figure out if you're friend or foe first. And it's been particularly difficult, I guess, in the last year and a half during the presidential campaign and after. One of the things that drew my attention to you during the presidential campaign, especially once you went to KYT Politics, but even before then, was that you weren't swept up in what I'll call anti-Trump hysteria, which I thought was important not to be swept up in that. Strangely, I'm one of the people who probably might fit into that category because I thought Trump really was a proto-fascist and a demagogue and a real threat. But I thought that if we were going to call him that, we should try to understand what that meant, why he was coming up now, and what we should do about it rather than just use that label as a cudgel. But you've been reluctant to go with that characterization of Trump at all. What was your feeling about that characterization of Trump as a proto-fascist?
Well, one thing that I detected pretty early on over the course of the 2016 campaign, and which really became inescapable, was that there was a fundamental inconsistency in at least the prevailing liberal critique of Trump or interpretation of Trump, and to some extent a leftist interpretation of Trump fell victim to this as well, which was you had beliefs attributed to Trump and qualities attributed to Trump that were constantly in conflict. So on the one hand, he was portrayed as this bumbling fool who couldn't run a campaign and was constantly immersed in a dumpster fire and was just out of control. And on the other, he was a fascist with a clearly defined worldview that would be used to further fascist ends. And I always felt that, you know, there was a tension there that needed to be at least gotten to the bottom of. And another reason why I felt that the critique was internally incoherent was that if you felt that Trump legitimately was a fascist, then I think that with that conclusion comes certain moral obligations. So if you believe that a fascist has a very good chance of taking over the reins of state, and namely the reins of the most powerful state in world history, the US, then I think more dramatic steps to counter that threat would be warranted than sitting around and hoping Hillary Clinton wins and refreshing 538.com every 5 seconds. I think it's morally incumbent on you, if you genuinely believe that to be true, to do things that are a lot more drastic than what liberals were willing to do. In fact, liberals often chastised leftist protesters for showing up to Trump rallies and, you know, physically, in some cases, preventing Trump supporters from entering the rally. I didn't particularly think that that tactic was efficacious, but if you're somebody who believed the most extreme interpretation of Trump as a fascist, I felt it would nonetheless be warranted. So there were just a lot of moving parts there that were never firmly established, and I think it's understandable that there would be some tension there in the prevailing interpretation of Trump, because he's a very unique political figure and it's difficult to get a full handle on what it is that he actually represents. Remember, this is kind of almost been forgotten at this point, but no other president had ever been elected without previously holding political office, without having been elected to anything previously, without serving in the military. He had to mount this hostile takeover of one of the two main parties in order to further his ambitions. So I think just assigning the simple label fascist to him kind of misstates the nature of the phenomenon, or misstates the nature of the problem, and can almost become this sort of analytical crutch that people use to skip over the necessary work of trying to actually decipher what it is that he represents. I mean, he's not easily characterizable.
My perspective on him at the time, during the primaries and during the general election, was that he was actually not as unusual a figure as he seemed. What was unusual was his success. You know, the Republican primary have been sort of a shit show for at least the last couple of elections. And I thought of him early on as someone who was just one of these early candidates who would be knocked aside eventually, but was catching everyone's imagination for a moment. But while that was going on, I run around on the Facebook left a lot. You know, I know a lot of people who talk about Marx and leftist theory and all that kind of thing. And what I noticed was that some of the people who I'd known for several years in that milieu were becoming Trump supporters, and their politics were radically changing, and that they were shifting from being far left to being, I would say, reactionary or neo-fascist or something like that. Not tons of people, but enough to really give me pause and make me very concerned. So I saw him as representing a movement that was behind him, that was part of the reason why he was gaining success, and that there were forces around him, like Bannon, that were proto-fascist or neo-fascist in some way that wasn't clear to me.
You know, it's funny, because if you recall, Susan Sarandon went on MSNBC, I believe, in March of 2000, 2016 and basically made an accelerationist case for Trump. Do you remember when this happened?
Yeah.
Right, but isn't the question always in an election about choices, right? I mean, I think a lot of people think to themselves, well, if it's Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and I think Bernie Sanders probably would think
this. I think Bernie would probably encourage people because he doesn't have any ego in this thing. But I think a lot of people are sorry. I just can't bring myself to do that.
How about you personally?
I don't know. I'm going to see what happens.
Really?
Really.
I cannot believe that as you're watching the rock,
well, you know,
Donald
some
Trump
people feel Donald
as
Trump will bring the revolution immediately. If he gets in, then things will really, you know.
Oh, you're saying the Leninist model of heighten the contradictions?
Yeah. Some people feel that.
Don't you think that's dangerous?
I think that what's going on now, if you think that it's pragmatic to shore up the status quo right now, then you're not in touch with the status quo. The status quo is not working, and I think it's dangerous to think that we can continue the way we are with a militarized police force, with a low minimum wage, with threats to women's rights, and think that you can't do something huge to turn that around, because the country is not in good shape. If you're in the middle class, it's disappearing. And you look, if you want to go see Michael Moore's documentary, you'll see it's pretty funny the way they describe it, but you'll see that health care, you know, and education in all these other countries, we've been told for so long that it's impossible. It's like we've been in this bad relationship, and now we have to break up with the guy because we realize we're worth it. We should have these things. We have to stop prioritizing war. And I don't like the fact that she talks about Henry Kissinger as being her, you know, go-to guy for and the stuff that's happened in Libya and other things I don't think is good.
She was, you know, roundly condemned for daring to make that case. But what she was really doing, and which got lost in the furious reaction to her comment, was, you know, she was stating that there are some people out there who hold that view, who view Trump as in some sense furthering leftist aims. It's not going to be a huge portion of the electorate by any stretch, but to deny that they exist I think is foolish. And sure enough, I mean, I think Trump was able to garner a sizable enough portion of the Bernie Sanders vote that it could have been electorally determinative, at least in some states. Again, it's not going to be a major portion of the electorate, but in a very close election, those kind of fringe or eccentric constituencies can add up.
Yeah. You had that kind of constituency behind Trump, the people who were legitimately still progressive in their attitudes, but had this accelerationist desire. I mean, maybe it wouldn't even be like a theory. There are accelerationists who, you know, can write books on that subject, but I think there was more of a sentiment. Michael Moore talked about that, you know, right before the election. This will be the ultimate fuck you vote.
You know, and just to interject, in a certain sense, even just an event that happened this past week could be argued that it would justify the accelerationist case for Trump that was made by some in 2016, and which I never endorsed, but I thought there was some denialism about its existence. I mean, obviously it did exist. It was never going to be a huge, overwhelming portion of the electorate again. But to deny that it existed seems so foolish to me. But for example, here's something that happened just this week. Trump apparently revealed classified information to the Russian ambassador, and the source of that information was Israel. In revealing the information, at least this is what's been reported, and you have to take these leaks with a grain of salt because people in the intelligence community who are purveying this information have their own motives, and many of them don't seem to be too favorably disposed to Trump. But that said, if we take what's been reported at face value, that Israeli this disclosure of Israeli intelligence really harmed the American relationship with at least the Israeli security state. Obviously, I think the spokespeople for Israel and for the United States are going to claim that there's no problem. But just today, you had an ex-Mossad chief saying that he would vociferously warn Israeli intelligence officers against providing sensitive information to the U.S. now. I mean, that's just kind of an amazing development. And if your idea was to back Trump in service of discrediting the apparatus of state and to making American imperium look foolish and to lose legitimacy, then he keeps seemingly proving that thesis correct.
Right. Which is why I feel it's so important, you know, as a publisher of a small imprint on theory and that kind of thing, to argue against accelerationism, because I feel like the American empire, the American juggernaut, the American state could be, it could fall apart partially, and the real forces in the world that we're fighting against, the capitalist system, basically would be just fine. It would just, the power would shift around geopolitically, and that you're not going to likely see much of a people's rebellion come out of this kind of disintegration of the American state. So, but that's to the side. The main thing I guess I want to get at here is just to back to the proto-fascism argument a bit, is that because not only did we see these accelerationist leftists come forward during the campaign, if you're looking at the fringe like I was and you were to a degree, I also saw real shifts in ideology amongst people who had been defining themselves against, say, capitalism or the U.S. state for a decade or more. They, you know, people became really neo-fascist or reactionary in this moment. And that's not unusual for a fascist movement to be able to take up some of the left as it builds. So for me, that seemed like a confirmation that there was some sort of neo-fascist or proto-fascist movement taking shape around Trump. But that didn't mean that Trump was a great vehicle for them or that he was a fascist himself.
I think that's a worthy distinction to make. I think what it definitely suggests is that there were latent forces within the populace that just needed some kind of external spur in order to kind of coagulate into what could be recognizable kind of political factions that maybe are different from what existed before. And I think, yeah, Trump was sort of a catalyst in that sense, and as was Bernie Sanders in another sense. I mean, I think one thing that the 2016 election really proved without question is that there was a reordering of American politics that was sort of waiting in the wings to happen, and it just needed, you know, attention to be concentrated on that reordering by way of a presidential campaign, which everybody is focused on. So are there some elements that coalesced around Trump that you could reasonably characterize as classically fascistic? Absolutely. But I think that the leap people make is to therefore conclude that Trump is himself a fascist or a Nazi. And again, I just think that misstates the nature of the problem.
Yeah, I do too. And it makes the problem, you know, you talked about this moral imperative to resist fascism, which, you know, I agree we would have, but one of the parts of that would be to resist fascism effectively, you know, to do something that might have a chance of working. And one thing that I've noticed is that there's not a lot of concern about that on the left right now, and I would include the far left in that. You're out there in town hall, I mean, you're seeing probably not the kind of far leftists that I talk to regularly, but how do you characterize the liberal left resistance to Trump?
You know, the liberal left resistance to Trump, and I would more characterize at least the people who are showing up to these town hall meetings, I would more characterize that as a liberal resistance, because it's being organized under the aegis of Democratic Party entities, essentially, that have a veneer of grassroots energy and to some extent actually do represent a genuine grassroots sentiment, but are definitely exist very comfortably with Democratic Party structures. You know, when I go to these meetings, and I've been to them in pretty disparate areas at this point, but you hear people repeating very similar mantras, and one trend that is very consistent is that they are very much fixated on Trump as a persona. They find him vulgar, and they find him just unacceptably crass, and I think there's some legitimacy to believing that. But you could tell that for a significant percentage of these people, it's just this visceral revulsion to Trump as a figure which seems to be animating them. And I just don't think that is necessarily conducive to a sustainable politics that actually seeks to get to the root of what could propel somebody with perhaps fascistic inclinations into power. I think a lot of the so-called resistance groups that have sprung up have been using the resistance moniker as sort of a branding opportunity. The Center for American Progress would be one example of that. I mean, they just held a conference this week in Washington, D.C. at the Four Seasons Hotel, and we're all talking all about resistance, and they've been selling T-shirts with the word resistance. But I don't think it's a particularly salient critique coming from them. So it just worries me that when people talk about, you know, the grassroots uprising that Trump has spawned, what seems to be the result more, it was more just kind of a somewhat myopic, visceral backlash to Trump as an individual rather than the conditions which gave rise to Trump.
If people are primarily concerned about Trump and they're primarily motivated to want to get rid of Trump, that's what their politics are about, then their best investment of their time and energy would probably be to join the Republican Party and support the Never Trump wing of the Republican Party. And that seems to be where Trump is most vulnerable, is from that wing of his own party. But I don't see a lot of people talking about doing that.
No, and I don't think that they there would ever be a scenario where they would do that. I mean, I just think they're seeking the emotional release and the emotional kind of satisfaction of seeing Trump just removed from power. And that would be an end unto itself for a huge section of these people. And I just don't think that's really a gainful goal. For one thing, Trump is sort of gumming up the system in a way that is impeding the Republican Party from enacting its agenda. You know, if your goal is to impede the Republican Party from enacting its agenda, you should, in some sense, want its most visible figure in the form of a president to not be personally competent. And so the status quo is sort of tenable in that sense.
Okay, but at this point, I think we may have to give up some hope that Trump will be able to stay in office for 4 years. If you have that perspective that maybe he's an asset to the Democratic Party, say, or to people who don't want to see, you know, the Obamacare or the ACA get decimated, because his actions recently have been so incompetent that it seems like it's hard to avoid the idea that he's obstructed justice. What do you think about his firing of Comey and his TV interviews? And I mean, how bad is this for Trump?
I think the real question now is whether this constant chaos or this constant uncertainty and this daily deluge of insane breaking news stories is sustainable. And I think you could determine whether it's sustainable by gauging the reactions of congressional Republicans. So if a critical mass of congressional Republicans deem that this is no longer sustainable, then it's incumbent on them and pretty much them alone to take some action to remove Trump. I think there is a very plausible case to be made that in firing Comey, Trump committed obstruction of justice. You have to separate that charge from whether Trump committed a criminal act, and it's somewhat doubtful that in firing Comey he did commit a criminal act. Again, we need more information. It could be corroborated in a legal sense that perhaps it did constitute a criminal act, but actually that's sort of immaterial to whether it could constitute an impeachable act, which is more a political indictment than necessarily a criminal indictment. So I think there are grounds potentially to impeach. I just don't think that if there's not some discovery of underlying criminality that stems from the whole Russia collusion narrative, then I highly, highly doubt that you'd have Republicans mobilized to actually impeach a president in their own party. And as yet, there's relatively little reason to believe that underlying criminality to that end does exist. So I think people need to step back and kind of take a breath and not get their hopes up. If their main goal in life is to remove Trump, I'm not convinced that we're necessarily on that path yet. It may well be that that happens, but again, I think there need to be some establishment of underlying criminality, not just that some inconsequential underling did something that violates some statute. No, I mean the main narrative, and the one that's been promoted by the Democratic Party and even some Republicans now for approaching a year, is that Trump committed a treasonous act by forming some kind of surreptitious pact with Russian state actors to get himself installed in power and then to enrich or support the Russian government's agenda. So I think there would have to be some criminality discovered that substantiates that thesis in order for the momentum to build around impeachment such that it's an actual feasible possibility.
Yeah. Well, it just seems to me that the obstruction charge is separate from the collusion charge. I mean, you could get – like Martha Stewart ended up in prison because she was obstructing justice and lying to the investigators, not so much for what she actually did. I feel like something similar could happen to Trump just if his popularity declines sufficiently, especially considering that he doesn't hide. He's done a very poor job of hiding his obstruction because he's actually announced it on television, you know, in that Lester Holt interview. I mean, do you interpret that the same way I did, that he basically came out and said, yeah, I fired him because I didn't like the Russian investigation?
No, he absolutely did state that just unequivocally, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, it's almost difficult to process how blatant it was. You could tell he's not the soundest legal mind if he's willing to just admit that on a national TV interview. But I just think, you know, so it's true that you can differentiate obstruction of justice from the collusion narrative. And at this point, you may well have sufficient grounds to conclude that there has been obstruction. I just think that in order to actually compel a Republican-held Congress to impeach a member of its own party, you'd have to have, again, something that validates the underlying collusion narrative rather than the second-order issues that have stemmed from it. So there was always a possibility that given the political pressure around the Trump collusion narrative, given that there's an FBI counterintelligence / criminal investigation underway, given that it's constantly in the news and there are constantly congressional testimonies pertaining to this collusion narrative, the political pressure would have built up on Trump and compelled him to take some act that is self-defeating and condemnable in its own right without necessarily validating the underlying collusion narrative. I think that's sort of a prerequisite for any kind of thoroughgoing movement toward actual removal. And given the lack of evidence to that effect yet, and we're now almost a year into these investigations, I think people would be justified in doubting that it ever really surfaces.
You're not convinced that there really was any collusion between the Trump campaign and Putin or Russian agents or anything along those lines.
You've been called an agent of the Kremlin, so have I.
Weird, because if you look at how this issue is talked about in terms of nomenclature, I mean, a lot of people will use the word interference, or in Russia mounted an influence campaign, or they meddled on behalf of Trump. So, you know, those words are always sort of nebulous, and it's not always entirely clear what specifically they're referring to. And I think it's purposefully vague, because so much disparate conduct could theoretically fit under that umbrella. And I think people who are looking for a smoking gun example of collusion, which would also fit under that umbrella, haven't yet found anything that's remotely viable.
Wait, what would count as collusion? Would, like, let's
that's
say
the thing, yeah.
If Putin hired, you know, sent some people over to the Trump campaign to help him run demographic studies on how to run his campaign because he supported Trump. And Trump knew that these people were coming from Russia to help him, you know, do polling. Would that count as collusion?
I don't know. I don't know what the actual criterion is for collusion. And that was also very seldom defined. I keep thinking back to the campaign of last year, which was really the genesis of this narrative. It was explicitly concocted by leading Democrats, including the Hillary Clinton campaign, who made it the centerpiece of their strategy for attacking Trump. So it was always sort of founded on dubious grounds, and then it kind of snowballed and took on a life of its own, and now we have potentially obstruction of justice stemming from it. But if you go and look at how the narrative was initially devised, it really wasn't founded on much at all. I mean, Hillary Clinton called Trump a puppet of Putin, but never really provided evidence that he was somehow in hoc to Putin in an explicit way that would substantiate that claim. And I think if that evidence existed now, we would have seen it.
Right. I mean, so I always took that to mean at the time when she said that at the time, I took that to be political speak. In other words, that she was saying that for whatever ideological reasons, for whatever reasons, Trump was too soft on Putin, that he liked him too much. They were in some way associated, and that because of that he had the wrong policy stances towards Russia, but not that she was making an actual legal charge, you know.
No, it wasn't a legal charge, but if, I mean, think about the connotation of the notion of a puppet.
Yeah, I know.
a puppet is somebody who is controlled by someone else.
Yeah.
So even if she wasn't explicitly stating that, I mean, that was the definite implication, and that is why so many people now earnestly believe that there was actual collusion, because you sort of, in order to be subject to the whims of a puppeteer, you have to collude with the puppeteer, I guess.
I mean, you don't actually. You can be someone's puppet, you know, like a useful idiot, is sort of, and that's not a stretch.
I suppose, and that term was also used pretty frequently. Again, it's sort of like a constantly form shifting allegation.
Yeah.
It's always kept sort of purposely vague, like I mentioned. So any number of these terms could conceivably fit under its umbrella.
I'll tell you one thing that changed because of that election is how many leftists are drawing a paycheck from RT. I mean, that's not acceptable.
That's something I'm accused of basically every day.
Right. Right. I mean, there were people who really were. They were being, you know, I assume, because they would be regularly on RT programs. And I don't know if they got paid for it or not, but they were regularly on RT. And it wasn't just a few. It was almost every major figure on the left has gone through the RT at one point or another, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and you know, I had been on it in a number of years ago, and I was never, right. I didn't have anybody, you know, pulling the strings or telling me what to say.
Right, right.
So there's
one of our
elevation.
Authors was just on RT, you know, and I said to him, "Did you get a big check from Putin? Because you're on there to talk about, you know, the NHS and how it's being privatized and attacked." He's like, yeah, I didn't get to meet Putin. It was unfortunate. But yeah, no, it's ridiculous. But that association now is, you know, RT is toxic now or radioactive or whatever.
Right. And that's another insidious aspect of all this that I've focused on in my reporting and commentary, that, you know, set aside the specifics of the allegations with respect to Trump-Russia collusion. Even if you pay no mind to that aspect of this, it's hard to deny at this point that the overall narrative has fomented a pretty insidious paranoia in the populace, especially among the center left and even to some extent the left. So now just appearing on RT guarantees that you could incur some kind of reputational sanction. When just a few years ago, it was seen as pretty ordinary to appear on RT, and the elevation of it as this kind of, you know, sinister state propaganda organ, I think is just incredibly overblown. But to the unschooled citizen who wants an explanation for why politics have been so upended and wants to seek out an explanation for how Trump could have possibly managed to win the presidency, I think they're taking at face value, or at least many of them are, these claims that kind of exalt RT and Russian influence into this villainous kind of centerpiece of American life. And I think that is really, really destructive, and it's going to have long lasting consequences. I can recall a town hall that I actually went to in West Texas a month or so ago, and it was populated by liberal activist types. I mean, a few of them do exist there. Mm-hmm. And so they were showing up for these town halls, and one guy who was, you know, on the surface appeared well-meaning and didn't seem like a bad person in the slightest. I mean, his priority was to just scream about RT. And I think, you know, the trajectory of this narrative has made it such that the unrelenting focus of a huge portion of a very activated, energized segment of the Democratic Party coalition is just inexorably fixated on Russia, and they've developed a paranoid streak, and they are now disposed to view any kind of interaction with a Russian official, or even in some cases a Russian, as somehow inherently suspicious. So I think that's just a very lamentable development, and you have to largely blame Democrats for fostering it. And the irony is, although it's had pretty destructive ramifications, it's actually, I think, in large part succeeded in creating a political environment that has hobbled Trump. And of course, Trump's own ill-tempered actions have contributed to that. But I think Democrats who have put this at the top of the agenda have actually been vindicated to some extent, because it actually has succeeded in hamstringing Trump.
Yeah, but there's a big downside to it, which is that you're trading domestic politics and some success maybe in hobbling your opponent for escalating international tension. I mean, that's not a good trade, I don't think. So, but I think it's a dangerous move to play politics that way.
No, it's incredibly dangerous, and I think people aren't even fully cognizant of how dangerous it is, because the constant tumult of what Trump is doing is sort of obscured how consequential this development is. I mean, Trump got up at the podium a month or so ago and declared that U.S.-Russian relations might be at their lowest point ever, and that was somehow taken as a victory by liberals. But really, I mean, we're only one kind of friendly fire incident or miscommunication away from all-out conflict. And the incentives are on Trump to actually carry out that conflict or potentially instigate one, because he has to be constantly proving how he's not, in fact, a puppet of Putin because of domestic political constraints. And I think it's just a really dangerous dynamic.
You recently posted a YouTube video from your kitchen. And by the way, I really like TYT Politics because it's a shoestring affair where you and Jordan and Emma report from your living rooms or your kitchen, or I guess the bathroom sometimes. Not on the toilet yet. But you released this YouTube video where you essentially called this story about the DNC staffer Seth Rich fake news. And do you want to clarify why you took that position?
Well, it was in my living room, just for the record. But I don't think I used the word fake news.
I'm paraphrasing that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm almost reticent to talk about this any further, just because I've been inundated with exhortations to address the Seth Rich issue now for the past 48 hours.
Well, I asked you in a very sympathetic way. I agree with you on this, but I just wanted to bring it up because there's one question I have, which is that after I watched your video and later on that evening, because of the YouTube algorithm, I saw Hannity, and Hannity showed a clip of Assange in an interview during the presidential campaign on Dutch television, intimating that Seth Rich was in fact his contact. That he didn't say it outright. In fact, he denied it, but he brought up the risks that the people who leaked to WikiLeaks face, and he gave Seth Rich's murder as an example of the kind of risks that people face when they give information to WikiLeaks, which of course intimates that maybe Seth Rich was a source for WikiLeaks. So what do you make of that is really what I was leading up to.
Yeah, I think there have been some intimations, whether you look at Assange's actual statements or some of the social media activity that the WikiLeaks accounts have engaged in. And I don't necessarily blame people for inferring that there is something salacious there. I think it's a little bit of deflection and sort of even a bit of cheekiness from Assange, maybe some opportunism. I don't think that necessarily confirms as well that he received, you know, the WikiLeaks disclosures from the Russian government either. He just kind of wants to create some uncertainty about the sourcing and just kind of challenge conventional narratives as he's wont to do. But there is a subsection of the what you might broadly call, I don't know, internet left, it's kind of like aggrieved Bernie Sanders people who have kind of forged an identity around being, in their view, deprived of their of the Democratic nomination, and who feel that they were robbed, and with some legitimacy. But that's sort of how now they self-identify and how they group themselves. And a lot of those people now are pretty fixated on this Seth Rich issue, because it seems to be the linchpin of a lot of what they suspect went on in the sort of like the dark recesses of the Democratic National Committee and the Hillary Clinton campaign. But to me, it's symptomatic of this. I'm just trying to figure out how to describe it. It's sort of symptomatic of this conspiratorial tinge subculture on aspects of – on elements of the internet left. And it's sort of almost speaks to a paucity of actual politics, where you have to kind of cling on to these kind of far-fetched explanations for events that probably at bottom are pretty banal and routine. There was this Democratic National Committee staffer who was murdered under somewhat suspicious circumstances in July of last year, and people have inferred that he was the source of the WikiLeaks documents. And then just this week, the Fox TV affiliate in Washington, D.C. ran with a story quoting a private investigator who had been allegedly retained by the family of the slain staffer, and basically it rocketed across conservative media. And
there was no there. He didn't actually have any physical evidence. In fact, it seemed to have been generated by a Fox News reporter, the whole story.
Right. So it fell apart among upon pretty cursory scrutiny and checking. But nevertheless, there is this kind of cohort on the progressive internet kind of wild west who think this is the central issue of our times. And I said something dismissive about it last night just because I think it's a little bit juvenile almost, and it's a little bit sad that there are so many people who are so desperate to believe that this is true. And so that was my thought.
Are you lonely? Do you feel like you're out on your own in the wilderness on this kind of stuff? Because I mean, I know sometimes you get into conflicts even with, you know, colleagues at TYT about Russia, or maybe this story about Seth Rich. I think Jimmy Dore disagrees with you about it, or Mike. So, do you feel lonely trying to be the voice of reason?
No, I don't feel lonely. I feel content. but you know, one thing about TYT that I think is so so necessary, and so and one of the reasons why I joined, and was because I was given assurance that I would be able to retain my independence and have a semblance of autonomy despite working within an institution. So I have no necessary it's not incumbent on me to account for what anybody else who might be associated with TYT has to say. The whole prerogative is that we are able to voice our independent our opinions independently and conduct our reporting without fearing that it might conflict with what somebody else has had to say. I think that's a marker of a healthy organization, and one that has, you know, some institutional flexibility. I don't feel lonely. I mean, I get into internet squabbles on a pretty regular basis, and people are always mad online, but at a certain point you don't take that personally, or you can't, and continue to exist. So
I continue to do the work you do anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. You know, you do a real service, I think, for people who want to get thoughtful alternative news or you know, more progressive news, but still objective most of the time. And so I really appreciate what you do. I wish I could ask you a question. I'm going to ask this question, but I know you're not going to be able to answer. But do you think Trump will make it through 4 years?
So you're asking me to engage in the kind of rote punditry that I kind of formulated identity around opposing. I mean, it's just such a constant soap opera. There's just this never ending plot twists, and it really is politics as entertainment, or actually as reality TV, which Trump himself knows a lot about.
Is he going to get voted off the island or not?
He's not. No, he's not going to get voted. If I had to just rattle off a projection, I would think that he actually does last the full four years. I mean, I think there's a tendency to in the moment think that the latest development is going to be his downfall, and kind of get wrapped up in whatever the present controversy or freak out is. But I think the American system is calcified enough that what it would take to remove him probably is not going to happen. At the very least, not before the 2018 midterms. I think we probably have to reevaluate at that point. But I would revise my projection to not before January of 2019.